Welcome to today's Manhattan Institute Innovative Ideas podcast. Our guest this afternoon is Richard A. Epstein, author of a new Manhattan Institute Project FDA report entitled How Conflict of Interest Rules Endanger Medical Progress and Cures. Richard is also the Lawrence A. Tisch Professor of Law at New York University, the Peter and Kirsten Bedford Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, and the James Parker Hall Professor at the University of Chicago. Richard, thank you very much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
Richard, where you start in your paper, I think, is acknowledging very frankly that there are legitimate concerns about conflict of interest in medicine, as there are in many other professions, but we've gone with a legitimate concern and run away with regulation run amok in this area to the point where, in the name of protecting patients, we're doing harm to them by slowing medical innovation. Could you talk about the move from legitimate to overbroad regulation?
Well, essentially, the central choice that you have to make in thinking about regulatory schemes is whether to have what is called an ex-ante system of regulation, which you subject everybody else to without any evidence of particular harms, or whether or not you want to wait till the process has run a couple of cycles and then impose sanctions on those people who deviate from the general norms. The usual sort of error analysis on this is that where most of the people working in a given profession are good eggs, ex-ante regulations are very costly because they slow them up, and they are imposed upon people whom 99.9% of the time do no particular harm. So in those circumstances, ex post remedies against the few malefactors can be quite heavy and will have a deterrent effect, which will reinforce the generally good norms that one finds in research science throughout the United States. What happens, of course, is in this current situation, the pall of suspicion makes it appear to many people as though virtually every scientist who works is in fact on the take. There are many books written about the pharmaceutical industries which have exactly that kind of title. Jerome Kircher wrote a book called On the Take with exactly that implication, and Martha Angel wrote one with a similar type of title. So the presumption seems to be that all these guys are in some sense improper, so that very heavy rules have to be put to limit what's going on. Now, if you guess wrong on this, what happens is by having these antecedent requirements, what you do is you either place cost barriers so people don't want to go through the hassle in order to do work with somebody in industry, or what you do is essentially you lead people to simply put up Chinese iron walls of one kind or another where nobody interacts. And the truth about the matter is knowledge in the sciences is highly diffuse. It is held in different quantities and in different ways by people in all branches, and the more that they could get together and talk, either in a conference or in an informal discussion or in a paid consultancy, the more likely it is that you to get the transmission of information from the places where it is had to the places where it is needed. And the difficulty in dealing with this field is that it is very difficult to point to any single interaction which is the source of a great collaboration. But what you can say with some degree of confidence is if you have thousands upon thousands of these interactions, each of them in its own incremental way will improve the picture as a whole. And the lack of a clear error analysis in this field has led people to impose heavier and heavier sanctions, so that when you speak to scientists in this area, they feel that in order to speak to somebody else, it's like speaking to a foreign alien who may well be a spy for another nation, and you're going to be under constant surveillance. It's a very unhealthy set of tactics, in my judgment.
What I really appreciate the paper is you look at the entire medical innovation industry from soup to nuts, so to speak, from the National Institutes of Health to the FDA and then to academic medical centers, and identify potential roadblocks or real roadblocks that have crept up as a result of conflict of interest regulation. But just to look at one specific instance, the FDA and its advisory committees that advise it on new drugs, what has happened there that has created a problem for the FDA in terms of getting the best expertise and advice it needs to approve new medicines?
Well, first of all, I mean, the FDA has its own particular biases. It tends to be much too risk-averse when it deals with new drugs, because if a bad drug gets out on the market or one is allowed to remain there, it gets all sorts of flack from everybody, whereas the harms that take place when good drugs are kept off the market or removed too quickly are much more difficult to pin down and isolate. So what has happened is when you start to bring this same sort of suspicion to the industry, what you say is as follows: we do not want to have on any FDA advisory committee any person who has extensive connections with the drug industry. What we want to do is to have people who are neutral. There are, however, no such thing as neutral people. Many of the people who do not have contacts with the drug industry have strong ideological commitments that new drugs, in fact, are generally bad and that generic drugs ought to be used in their place. That itself can easily skew judgment. In addition, it turns out that when you take these people, you cut out a huge portion of the available talent to deal with these things, so that at this point, roughly about one-third of the FDA advisory committee seats are empty. Well, what makes it even worse is the disclosures you require of everybody, whether or not they're involved in some kind of industry connection, become more and more elaborate, so you want them to expose the specific amounts of money that they receive for doing various kinds of work, and that's just a huge deterrent. Nobody likes to sort of disclose their income. They don't put it on their forehead. Why the FDA should first require it of themselves and then say that it's entitled to distribute it to the public at large seems to me to be just compounding the crisis in question. As I said, I do think it is appropriate when there are conflicts of interest to make disclosures. The disclosures should be to people into power. Where the conflicts turn out to be acute, what you have to do is to ask somebody to separate himself from the process. And that would mean, for example, that if you had a drug coming from Pfizer, you would not want a member of the Pfizer company to sit on the review board, even though you might call him up in order to ask questions about the way in which the drug has operated. But if you have somebody from one large pharmaceutical company, it seems to me to be perfectly appropriate to allow it to sit in judgment, or at least to participate on a committee that evaluates the product of another large company. I sat for several years on one of these review committees inside the University of Chicago, overseeing work for an NIH grant on immune tolerance, and we'd managed to develop perfectly sensible protocols in which strong staff work, coupled with a sense of public discourse amongst the members of the committees, reduced these conflict risks to minimal levels. And indeed, I can't even think of a single case, maybe there was one, in which somebody felt that he was obliged to recuse himself or herself from a particular discussion. If you talk about conflicts enough, after a while, they become the only issue on the table. When in fact, if you've got careful committee structures, for the most part, these things are sources of only minimal conflict.
I'd like to talk about some of the solutions you point to in a moment, but I'd like to go back to that issue of having people with interest sitting on committees, because one thing that seems lost in this discussion is the cross-cutting influences. In other words, you're not there just representing your interest, you're also protecting your reputation as a candid expert. So that it's not at all clear that even if someone who has a financial obligation to company B is not going to be a fair observer of company C's product.
Well, I mean, there is always the question of direct competition as to whether or not you leave people on committees where those things are done. The usual rule that I would follow, and I think is generally followed in private institutions that do this right, is if there's somebody else who has comparable qualifications, then you don't want the fellow from the direct competitor on there. But oftentimes, these markets are much thinner than you might expect, because what happens is you're not just asking about diabetes, you're asking about complex chemical reactions involving a single drug that operated at a single genetic site, and under these circumstances, the markets may be a lot thinner. And there's no way you can kind of ordain what the proper result is in advance. All you can do is point out the relevant considerations and have the people who are in charge of the committees make those kinds of judgments. But knowledge is very hard to come by. And if you look in other businesses, including the practice of law, generally speaking, where you have expertise, people are very, very reluctant to knock folks out on generalized suspicion. The better approach is to start working with this particular area, and if things go well, you keep going. If it turns out a serious conflict emerges, what you ask of the individual staffer or the individual committee member is to disclose that, at which point dismissal can take place. But most of the time, it doesn't happen, so you don't want to kill off your first best people to take your second best people. And in fact, in the medical profession, there's a common aphorism that goes around hospitals, which is that the only people who don't have their hands in consulting or in starting new companies and so forth are those who are at the back end of the profession in terms of their competence, imagination, and ability. And I happen to think that there's probably a lot of truth in that. And the last thing we want to do if business seems to set the sensible business arrangements are to allow for split times is to force people to take either one thing up or another, to either deprive academics of some of the best researchers who now spend all their time in industry, or to do it in exactly the opposite direction so that you don't get people who have a foot in both camps. To me, the basic judgment is, on average, it's a good investment of public time, money, and effort to allow people to work in both camps. And the view that somehow or other this is impermissible has gone way over the top. In fact, it's gone so far over the top that in many cases, there are people who argue that disclosure, full and complete as it may be, to proper officials is never enough, and that we have a per se ban without even bothering to examine the particulars of these cases. Once you realize how thin these markets are at the level of sophistication you're working with, then I think you'd come to realize that these are very, very broad, very excessively prophylactic measures. There are narrow and more tailored ways in which to deal with these problems.
So I think your overall message is more intelligent management of conflicts, not the assumption of guilt that we seem to be operating under now.
That's clearly right. Essentially what happens is conflicts of interest arise whenever you have two people with divergent objectives, and all you need to have a conflict is two people. You don't want to treat something which is a pervasive portion of human endeavor as though it's an absolute veto on cooperative efforts. There are ways to deal with these particular problems by folks who are sensitive to it. In all the years that I've worked on these conflict issues, I can't think of a single case where somebody did not want to back out when it turned out that a conflict was revealed. Remember, as you said earlier, the reputational effects of taking bad behavior in an FDA committee, say, for example, where there's 30 of your prominent guys, all who think you're acting like a jerk, is a very powerful sanction. And once you have those kinds of informal sanctions that are in place, you really want to be very careful before you exercise the nuclear option of automatic exclusion.
30 of your peers who are going to be asked by the NIH to rule on your next grant. You don't.
And it doesn't even matter at some point. It's just that reputations right. matter in closed communities.
Right.
And people who start to misbehave lose these things very quickly. And even if it's not a grant, it may be an invitation to participate on a project or to give a speech somewhere or to teach a course or to co-author on a paper. People live their lives in fishbowls when they become eminent professionals, and they understand all of this. And the sort of the naive assumption that somehow or other everybody is just one inch from going over the edge and it's only the strong and draconian hand of the sort of the FDA or the university police that stop him is a real mistake. And with private institutions, this is not a question of public regulation. It's just, I think, a question of systematically bad judgment. And the universities that put these crazy rules in place, as they often are the same ones that could remove them upon a more sober reflection as to the gains and losses that you get from these processes.
Last quick question. So having acknowledged we've gone too far, perhaps way too far, do you think we're due for a reapproximation at some point? Are people starting to realize we're inhibiting more of these important innovative efforts?
Look, it's very hard to find out the particular innovations that are killed because by definition they haven't taken place. But I do think that what happens is the shoe starts to pinch on perfectly sensible ventures, people from inside the professions will start to push back. And in addition, I think the anti-regulatory move will gain from the fact that throughout the United States at large, there's the increasing perception that we've gone over the top with regulation in so many areas that we have essentially no headroom for further adjustment. And it's exactly that particular kind of sentiment, which when carried over to this area, will change sort of public sentiments. We need to get ourselves into deregulatory mode, not because we're anarchists, not because we pretend that conflicts don't exist, but because we understand that matters of degree, when wrongly calibrated and wrongly decided, can often be more deadly than even decisions that make yes or no, up or down kinds of choices.
Richard, that's a terrific note to end on. Thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure.